You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Atlantic Ocean has been the stage for commerce, great naval battles, and emigration. It was formed 370 million years ago, but scientists estimate that humans didn't venture out into its vast waters until just about 1,000 years ago. In Atlantic, great sea battles, heroic discoveries, titanic storms, and a vast ocean of a million stories, Simon Winchester tells the epic tale of the ocean. In addition to having lived on both sides of the Atlantic, Mr. Winchester is a best-selling author with a degree in geology. His book is published by Harper, and it is my great pleasure to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Thank you so much.
So let's start at the very beginning. The Atlantic is the smaller of the oceans. The Pacific is bigger. How was it formed? Were they formed at the same time?
No. The Atlantic was formed about 200 million years ago when there was a huge supercontinent called Pangaea, which probably all of us vaguely remember from school days. And surrounding it was a huge sea called Panthalassa. And then, because of the convection currents in the core of the Earth and the forces it brought to bear on Pangaea, Pangaea split apart about 200 million years ago. And the water from Panthalassa surrounding it gushed into the cleft, as it were. And that was the technical beginning of the ocean. It didn't really begin to assume the shape it has now, this sort of S-shaped, rather sinuous thing that we know and love. That began to be formed about 40 or 50 million years. So initially it had other names. I mean, geologists call it by other names, but the Atlantic, which comes from the Atlas Mountains, it assumed its present shape about 50 million years ago.
So not all that long ago, actually. But tectonic plates are continuing to move. And the Atlantic is continuing to expand, isn't it? Something like an inch or two a
year?
Yes, I was
going to say, since from starting this book to publishing it, I think it widened by about 3 inches.
Now, does that mean that the Pacific is getting smaller?
I believe technically, well, it's changing shape. It's not quite getting smaller. It's becoming sort of lopsided because California is moving northwards, and it's all very weird, but it's... One thing you've got to remember is that there's a finite amount of water on this planet, and the continents are jostling about and bouncing off each other, all in very, very slow motion. And the shapes of the bodies of water are constantly changing. So the Atlantic is becoming wider, the Pacific is becoming more lopsided.
When will this become a problem for map makers?
Well, technically it's a problem now, because those poor people and the people that set the boundaries of the ocean. So these three admirals who sit 5-year periods in Monte Carlo, of all places, and they draw,
why not? That's a nice
exactly,
place to be sitting.
No, they're just sitting there. And the chief admiral, who's an Australian, he's quite interested in the sea, but his main interest is HO gauge model railways. And so he has this huge set up. But he says, and the other two of them, where the boundaries of the oceans and seas are. And for instance, the Gulf of Mexico, where the Deepwater Horizon exploded and sank, that is technically in the Atlantic Ocean. So the Atlantic includes the Gulf of Mexico.
You end your book with an environmental message. Are you concerned about what's happening to the Atlantic?
Well, I'm concerned, as I think we all should be, about the way that we are carelessly disrespectful of the ocean. I mean, for years we thought, it's so big you can throw anything into it, it'll just absorb it. Well, it doesn't. I mean, mercury being a classic example, which is why we shouldn't eat tuna anymore. But I mean, the British government for years was just throwing all its nuclear waste off Cornwall, off Ireland, off Scotland, saying, it'll dilute it, it'll be trivial. Well, it's not trivial. And we do great damage to the seas, and it's coming back to bite us, basically.
And then what about climate change? What effect will that have on the Atlantic, or I guess all the oceans?
Yes, but I mean, insofar as the great cities that we're fascinated by in and around the Atlantic, and they are being affected by, and the climate change is causing, there's no doubt about this, the cause of climate change, there's still debate, of course, but the sea is getting warmer, which means the sea is getting fatter, it's rising, and also the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica are melting, adding to it. And some cities are dealing with it, the rise in sea levels, and some cities are not. A classic example of a city that is Rotterdam. A city that's dealing with it hardly at all is London, and a city that's dealing with it a little is here in New York.
Now, Rotterdam, what are they doing, building more dikes?
excuse me. What they're doing is that they're saying, we're not going to try and do what Venice is doing, which is protecting ourselves by building dikes and preventing the sea. I mean, that is a sort of a King Canute kind
of... holding back the
holding sea. Holding back. It can't be done. You would have thought any good European would realise that after the King Canute story. No, they're deciding to build things that float. And so they're building apartment blocks and shopping malls and so forth that are going to be accommodated. And the city will eventually float. And why not? How sensible is that?
Venice is talking about jacking itself up. Would that work?
Jacking itself up will work temporarily, and I mean, for a thousand years maybe. But
then the water will get up to the new level.
It'll keep on moving. It's not going to stop. I mean, the Marsh Arabs had the right idea in, after all, the cradle of civilization in Mesopotamia. They built houses that floated. And that's very sensible.
And it was until Saddam Hussein that worked quite well.
Indeed.
Until Saddam Hussein. New York, you say, is dealing with it to some degree, and London not at all?
Well, London sort of thought itself very cocky about 30 years ago when it built that extraordinary barrier near Greenwich, the Thames Barrier, to prevent the tidal surges. Because if you remember the shape of the Thames estuary, it's like a funnel. And if you get a big tidal surge in the North Sea, it rockets into London and then we get into the subway system, which is the big problem. And so they built this very futuristic-looking Thames Barrier, which now, of course, doesn't look futuristic at all. It looks like something really strange.
And it's kind of like a Maginot Line. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but
right.
It doesn't work.
No, and you can go around the edges. You'll flood Dagenham and you'll flood the Isle of Sheppey or something, and it'll just go around the edges, just as the Germans did with the Maginot Line. So they need to have a more constructive approach. And with London and New York, it'll probably have to be, in that there is these various sophisticated subway systems, then to keep them intact, there will have to be almighty pumps and so forth. So,
and is New York building pumps?
New York is building pumps, yes. And apparently this is, yes. And New York is taking it very sensibly.
My guest is Simon Winchester, whose latest book is Atlantic, Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories. Let's go back to the beginning. Well, it's been around a long time, 50 million years, you say. When did humans first begin taking advantage of it?
Well, before taking advantage, there's research going on at the University of Arizona about when they first encountered it. And that was apparently there's a sea cave called PP13B in a cliff in South Africa at a place called Pinnacle Point. That seems to be the first place where 164,000 years ago, they can date it very precisely, humankind first saw the sea.
That's before they went to Europe or the other side of Africa.
Indeed, yes. So a very long time ago when humankind, as it were, born, if I can put it that way, in Ethiopia, coming down the savannah, suddenly come to a cliff edge and there is this limitless body of water. What do they do? Well, according to the archaeological evidence, they did something which G.K. Chesterton found rather amazing. He said it was a brave man who ate the first oyster. Well, it was the first men who ate the first oysters, because their cave is littered with oyster shells. And I also write that, like, the irony that up above the cave and sort of completely unaware of its existence is a golf course, which is called the Garden of Eden golf course. So it's as if Adam and Eve were below. So, but the first people to exploit the ocean, to go back to your question, were the Phoenicians, and that was about 700 years BC before Christian era.
But of course, they were going through the Mediterranean. Were they going into the Atlantic as well?
Well, that's the thing. They had their trade from Tyre and Sidon had been exclusively within the relatively benign waters of the Mediterranean. You could see beyond the Pillars of Hercules, with Gibraltar on the right and Jebel Musa in Morocco on the left, this sort of roiling grey entity that Homer had written about, the sea of perpetual gloom. I mean, this was, if you ventured through that, you'd fall off the edge of the world, as far as you knew. It was terrifying, but they did. They decided in about 720 BC, in their tiny little boats, these things called hippoi, to go out into this sea. And they found they could navigate. And they turned left and went down to what is now the port of Essaouira in Morocco. And there are these little islands, which are now called the Purple Islands. There they found these huge quantities of a shell, a gastropod called Murex brandaris, which they had already found in the Mediterranean, which they knew if they boiled it down, you could extract this beautiful, indelible purple dye, which is what the Mediterranean aristocracy, the Romans particularly, born to the purple, would dye their clothes with. And so they set up a business. And so the first trading post was in the Atlantic. So our first exploration of the ocean was motivated by market forces.
But it was going along the African coast. We also, there are people who conjecture that the Portuguese, or the Basque anyway, followed the cod in across the Atlantic way before Columbus, way before the Vikings.
Indeed. I mean, the Irish, of course, in about 500 AD, going up to first the Faroes and then turning left and going to Iceland. The Basques following the cod. I mean, the Gaspé Peninsula in Quebec is Gaspé is a word from northern Spain. And yes, indubitably they were there. And one thing about that I'm hoping I'll manage to get across in this book without being banned from every Italian restaurant in New York for the rest of my life is to remind people that Columbus did not get there first, that Leif Erikson got there first. And 491 years before Columbus, and built a settlement and had a child.
Although we don't know what they were thinking, we do know that Columbus, at least according to the story I was told in school, thought he was going to Asia.
Columbus indeed thought he had arrived in Asia. I mean, he thought Hispaniola was indeed sort of part of the Spice Islands. And, oh, that wasn't very difficult. You know, it only took 60 days or something, and nice weather. Leif Erikson, I mean, they settled. They were nice to the local people. They had cattle, and they had this child. They conceived the first European child born in North America.
Now, there was a lot of activity on the Pacific Ocean, even before, wasn't there? Why do you think it took so long for the Europeans, and I'm assuming Africans as well, to have ventured out into the Atlantic when the Pacific, a much vaster ocean, was traversed centuries before?
Well, that is, yeah, it's a fascinating question, but it actually stymied me particularly because the genesis of this book on the Atlantic, I was born out of a failure of an earlier book I wrote on the Pacific when I lived in Hong Kong. Everyone was telling me that the Pacific is the ocean of the future. And so I journeyed all over it for a couple of years and wrote a book saying this is the ocean that we should all look towards. But what I didn't realize is that despite what you just said, there isn't much of a human history to the Pacific. Yes, there are the Polynesian navigations, which obviously you're alluding to.
But they may have gone all the way to South America.
They may indeed have done so. And navigating without the use of longitude and latitude, without the use of, you know, the kind of clocks that John Harrison was forced to invent in the 18th century.
And less sophisticated boats.
Much less sophisticated boats. But most people crossed the Pacific by land because, of course, there was the land bridge. And all North American, Native Americans are, of course, people that came by land from Siberia. And that's the big difference. There was no land bridge across the Atlantic.
The Atlantic has spawned stories of sea monsters, maelstroms, whirlpools, waterspouts, all that kind of stuff. How much of it is based on real things?
Well, whirlpools, actually, there's a lot of basis. And I had one of the most delightful assignments of my journalistic career, I think, once the Smithsonian sent me to do a piece on all the world's whirlpools. And so I went to the Maelstrom, which is just to the south of the Lofoten Islands in Norway. And believe you me, a terribly, terribly frightening thing to be. I was in a boat and we were whirling round and round and round.
And that goes on constantly?
Well, it's a tidal race. And so it gets particularly ferocious when the tide is running. There's another one which I lived near for 5 or 6 years in Scotland called the Corrie Vrekken, which if you ever go and see my favorite film in all the world, which is called I Know Where I'm Going, the Corrie Vrekken whirlpool plays a star part in it.
That's Michael Powell's great film.
Wonderful, wonderful film. We could talk for hours about that, I think.
Yes.
So whirlpools, yes, exist. The monsters, maybe not.
But only in the Atlantic? Aren't there equivalents in other oceans?
There is one big whirlpool in Japan, but aside from that, in terms of legend, no, there are not many legends about whirlpools and monsters in the Pacific.
We don't hear much about pirates in the Atlantic anymore, but didn't pirates really begin in the Mediterranean and the Atlantic way before they were in Asia or off the coast of East Africa?
Oh, absolutely. And this is one of the shameful, didn't last for terribly long, and it's very much romanticized, of course, nowadays. And we think of, you know, yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum and a chap with a parrot on his shoulder and a peg leg. But they're much more ferocious and unpleasant. And one of the things in the book is to try and redress the balance and remind ourselves that piracy was a very, very horrible business.
One of the things you look into is the way the Atlantic is described by people on both sides of it. Do Americans have a different view of the Atlantic, or Canadians, or Mexicans than the British and the French and the Africans?
Well, it's interesting. There is, yes, a very different cultural view of the Atlantic. The Atlantic is seen by many Africans, not all, but many Africans, as having a sort of a mystical force that people that are involved in it have, well, without being unduly vulgar, I mean, there's a sort of a sea goddess that invests itself in the shape of beautiful ladies of the night in many West African cities. And so it's a sort of a symbol of fecundity and love and, you know.
Well, it was a source of food.
Well, indeed it was. And so there's that attitude in Africa. In South America, there was very little evidence that any of, for instance, of the advanced cultures of Latin America ever attempted to cross the Atlantic. The Caribs, there may have been an attempt. Columbus records in some marginalia in a notebook of his that there may have been Caribs found in Ireland. Mm. It's fairly fanciful. But to us in the West, it was or in Europe, rather, on the eastern side of the Atlantic, it was an ocean to be sailed across and conquered.
Well, there are people in Mexico who believe that the Olmecs came from Africa.
There are these
the first
beliefs.
Civilization.
Well, I mean, there are all these stories. I mean, coca leaves found in sarcophagi in Egypt suggesting that people from Venezuela got to the Nile. I don't think
and
so.
And arrowheads that look more European than they do Asian.
And Roman coins in Newfoundland. It goes on.
There was a time not all that long ago when many people traveled to Europe on ocean liners like the Ile-de-France and QE2. Has air travel replaced that completely?
Essentially, but also what has replaced it is that the ships that cross the Atlantic, and indeed all of the oceans today, divorce you utterly from the sea. I mean, you're encouraged not to be on deck, sort of seeing the salt air and the seagulls and the wind. You ought to be downstairs or below, I should say, gambling and going to the Vuitton shops and so forth. So you're divorced from the sea whether you travel by air or by sea.
We have very little time, but your first in your subtitle, the first thing mentioned is Great Sea Battles. Has the Atlantic seen most of the great sea battles, except for World War II?
Except for Midway and Straits of Tsushima. Yes, are the big ones. I mean, Trafalgar, Battle of Jutland, the Falkland War, great set-piece battles, nearly all of them fought on the Atlantic.
And most of those ships still on the floor of the Atlantic.
Lying at the bottom, yes.
And the Titanic is still there.
Indeed, an awful lot of ships, yes.
Simon Winchester is the author of many books, including The Professor and the Madman, The Man Who Loved China, A Crack on the Edge of the World, Krakatoa. His latest is called Atlantic, Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories. And we barely scratched the surface of those stories, but I guess that's why they publish these things, right? The book is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks again. Thank you. Thank you.